Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I was just thinking before we went on the air, I wonder how many people on Earth right now are going to be able to have the great privilege of talking about John Quincy Adams for the next hour. And I was thinking it's probably not very many, so I hope there are quite a few of you who will, with me, have the great pleasure of learning a great deal about our sixth president, John Quincy Adams, who was an incredible person. He was an incredible person by the time he was 12. He, of course, the son of John Adams and Abigail Adams, sixth president of the United States, former ambassador to the courts of London and St. Petersburg, secretary of state to James Monroe, and then a member of Congress, where he did some remarkable things. A man of, as our guest says this hour, immense physical and moral courage, who was happiest, really, when he was alone. He accomplished little of his ambitious agenda, but he had a whole lot to say and was important in formulating some policies that were very important to the beginnings of our country. So we're going to learn about John Quincy Adams. We love doing these presidential, at least I do, I hope you do too, some of you do, presidential history shows. So we have another this hour. James Traub is our guest. He is the author of John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit. He's a contributor at foreignpolicy.com. Regularly, he teaches foreign policy at New York University and is author of other books, including The Freedom Agenda. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. James Traub, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, and I'm so happy you wrote this book. I love reading about interesting presidents. And this guy was an unbelievable person by the time he was 10, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, he might have been a happier person if he'd been a little bit less incredible by the time he was 10.
Right.
You know, I mean, there is an argument which would have meant nothing at that time but does to us now, you know, that people need to have their childhoods. Of course, you know, in those days, that was something you escape from as soon as possible. And in any case, his parents were pretty content to let the other kids in the family have a more or less normal childhood, but not John, not the oldest boy. And so, yes, he was raised from the beginning to be, not of course, to be president. His father didn't know he'd be president at the time. But he was raised to be a citizen of a republic that did not yet exist, but which both of his parents knew would be coming into being. And they felt it was immensely important to raise their children, and above all, this young man, as a kind of exemplar of what American citizenship should be.
Mm-hmm. You start early on in the book describing, and it will forever stay in my mind after reading a lot of your book, his mother, Abigail Adams, taking him to the top of a hill so he could see the Battle of Bunker Hill, and then imparting the knowledge to him how important this was, and also giving him a prayer to the martyred soldiers that he remembered to his dying day.
Well, the prayer was, so yes, so you're absolutely right. He's 8 years old, and he lives a few miles away from a hill that, from which one can see across Boston Harbor. It's almost 10 miles away to Dorchester, where Bunker Hill was. And she brings him up to this hill, and he sees the smoke and the flames. He probably couldn't see much more than that, after all. And he learns later that the family doctor, a very beloved figure named Joseph Warren, from a very illustrious family, was killed in one of the early charges. And his mother sang him this song. It was actually a song sung by Irish patriots.
Oh.
But it was appropriate because, of course, it was an anti-English song, because the Irish, like the Americans, were colonialized people who were seeking their freedom from England. And so it's a song about martyrdom, how blessed those who fall in the name of freedom. And yes, she sang him this song, which was really kind of like a hymn, when he was a little boy. And he, 70 years later, when he was taxed by an Englishman, "Why are you so anti-British?" And he said, "Well, that is because in my childhood, I saw the terrible things the British did to the Americans, and my mother was a great patriot, and to this day I have not forgotten the words of the hymn she sang me," and he then proceeded to write them down word for word, and they were letter perfect.
He had a mind. Oh, he had a mind. You talk about his mother being in charge of him. ages 7 to 11, and before that, too. His father from 11 to 16. Tell me about those years and the different kinds of influences from Abigail and later from John.
Well, there, at one level, I would say there was no disagreement between them. They had very much the same vision of what it meant to raise a young man, but of course they were very different people. And so the mother, who was the daughter of a minister, I would say had a more Christianizing effect in him and put in him the fear of sin that he lived with his whole life. I mean, in that sense, the more puritanical side of him probably came more from the mother. But she, too, when he was 8 years old, seven maybe, she had him reading from a book of history, very popular. It was one of the most popular works of ancient history then in the United States. It was meant for adults, not for children. A children's book then meant a kind of Jack and Jill primer. And so the purpose of this was not only to make him a better reader and so forth, it was so that he understood that in the history of each country, he could read its destiny. And so he was reading about these ancient tyrannies that, of course, all came to no good, these empires. And so implicit in all this was the idea that the United States, when it came into being someday, would be a very different kind of place. So she educated him because John was off at the Continental Congress. What then happens is that John Adams is sent to Paris as part of a team that is negotiating in order to get assistance from the French in 1778 originally, and then he goes back a second time. And so during that period, which really runs until 1783 when John Quincy comes back to the United States to go to Harvard, he's under his father's wing, and his mother's not there. And so his father really puts him through his paces on the great classic writers, on the English poets, but also on mathematics, on everything it meant to be an educated man. And perhaps there the emphasis was both on literary and classical knowledge and also Republican understanding, what it means to be the citizen of a republic.
Yeah, it was amazing what all he learned and what he was studying. Let's go back, though, to Abigail saying goodbye in what must have been, and you write about this 6-week incredibly treacherous journey across the Atlantic, where she was well aware, and they must have been, maybe not John Quincy, but his father, that they could not, maybe they wouldn't return. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'd be lost at sea.
Yeah, and they'd be stopped by pirates. I mean, they left in a very stealthy way because John Adams was already a marked man, and there was every good reason to fear that if the British found him, they'd hang him. So yes, lost at sea or hanged. And I think perhaps one thing you're thinking of when you ask about that is that when he reaches the other side, he's now writing his mother letters from Paris, which, like any boy like that, he just adored. And he's going to the theater, and he's living a very adult life, and he's just enchanted. And his mother reads this and thinks, oh my God, we're losing him. We're losing him to sin.
Right.
And she writes back in a tone that freezes your blood, and she says, you must always remember who you are. She said, if you become a European with debauched morals, she said, I would rather that you perished beneath the sea.
Woo.
I'd rather you be dead. This is not a formula for raising a happy, comfortable child, though it certainly is a formula for raising a conscientious one.
Yes, absolutely. You wonder, and let me ask, because you talk about this in the book too, what would have happened if his mom and dad had given him unconditional love? He may have been a happier person, but maybe not as successful a person? What do you think?
How can we know these things? But, I mean, I do say that in so many stories of great men or women, you read that there is one parent, usually the mother, but not always, who says, you are the greatest. I love you, and whatever you do is good, and you're going to be a fabulous person when you grow up. Mm-hmm. The other one may be absent, may be harsh, but that is enough to buoy a person up and give him or her tremendous confidence. Well, he didn't have that. His parents would have thought that was a terrible thing to say, because yes, there was a part of them that had a kind of Rousseauian sense that a child was this open, flowering thing that needed to be nurtured and encouraged. But there was another part of them that had a deeply Puritan sense that human beings will go wrong, that they are creatures of vanity, of their own appetites, and those things must be curbed, and therefore one must build up their moral sense in order to prevent them from surrendering to those appetites. He was raised that way, and I don't think there was a moment that he ever questioned that that was right.
Mm. He became, and tell me how this happened. No, let's go back to Paris for a moment. So they're in Paris, and they're kind of going to other places in Europe as well. Tell me about the cast of characters and the friendships that emerged, even though he was very young, his father's friendship, or at least Benjamin Franklin.
Right. So this is somebody who, John Quincy Adams, though he lives till almost the Civil War, he knows Benjamin Franklin. I mean, Benjamin Franklin is there in Paris. His father takes him to Franklin's house, and indeed, at first they live in the carriage house of the larger estate in what is now the 16th arrondissement of Paris, where Franklin was. So he knew Franklin pretty well. The person he was really close to was Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And you always have this feeling when he's writing about Jefferson as a 15-year-old that Jefferson was like an uncle. You know, he's got these parents who are so demanding and in front of whom he must be so correct. And Jefferson, as we all know, was a charmer. He was not strictly confined to the truth. He was a little bit of a fabulist, but he was a romantic figure. He was tall and handsome. He was probably lonely then. His wife had died. And so John Quincy, age 14 or 15, goes to Jefferson's house in Paris almost every day. And I'm
Goodness.
Sure Jefferson treated them as an adult. It was probably immensely flattering to him. But it wasn't only Jefferson. I mean, some of the figures who we read about in the literature of the time, the Abbé Sieyès, for example, a French cleric who was a great intellectual, that was somebody who Adams knew. I think even figures like Constable, the American painter, he knew all these people. He would even introduce them
Amazing.
To each other, this
right.
15-year-old boy.
Where were the other 14 and 15-year-olds?
He had one friend like him. And I, you know, so far as I can tell, America produced one person like him. And that is John Jay, another, of course, of our great founding fathers, also sent to Paris to negotiate the treaty at the end of the Revolutionary War, had a ward. It wasn't his son. He was a boy he adopted named Monroe. Peter's called Peter J. Monroe. And the two boys, who both spoke perfect French and were both so unbelievably worldly and were terribly erudite, but were 15-year-old boys, had this friendship. And we know that because they wrote letters to each other. And every once in a while, one of them says something like, I hope you didn't tell anyone about our little peccadillo, you know, over the summer. We don't know what it was. It was probably something quite harmless.
Mm-hmm.
But they would talk about their crushes on girls. Adams would send him poems that he claimed to have found somewhere, though, of course, there were poems that he wrote, but he wouldn't admit to it, which were all kind of rather, you know, erudite flights, but they were all about, you know, girls, women, you know, actresses whom he had a crush on, things like that.
And that started his love of theater. It was a lifelong love of theater, being in Paris when he was that age, didn't
it? Yeah, so that started when he was 10. And his father, he wrote to his sister once that, you know, what am I doing in Paris? Because she said, write to me everything while you're there. And so he said, this is when he was still a little boy, still 10. He said, well, every once in a while, Papa brings me to spectacles. And a spectacle must have been like a kind of vaudeville show. It was low theater, not high theater. And by the time he's older, he would never have gone to such a thing. He would have thought it was childish. But when he was a little boy, he was agog. And so, yes, this lasted his whole life. When he comes back to Paris at age 48 or so, when he is negotiating the treaty to end the war of 1812, he comes back to Paris for the first time in decades, and he describes going to the Comédie Française, and he's sitting in the pit with all the other ordinary people, and he's seeing a Molière play, and he describes the fact that everybody, these people in the pit, who of course are working class people, are repeating the lines before the actor says them, because they know every word, because they are such fanatics for theater. And to him, that was a kind of paradise.
How does he become minister to St. Petersburg? I believe he's not even yet 13 or 14. How old is he?
Well, so he's not minister. So what happens is he's 13. So what happens is there is this belief that Catherine the Great, who famously sheltered Voltaire, was therefore considered kind of an enlightened figure, that she would probably be pro-American. She'd be in favor of republics. And so the decision was made that we've got to send a minister there. So Francis Dana, who was in Paris and is a friend of the Adams family, was sent off to go. But Francis Dana didn't speak French, much less Russian. Well, French was the language of the court. You didn't need Russian. You needed French. Well, who was going to go with him who spoke French? And nobody wanted to go. I mean, you know, Russia is the edge of the universe. It's like saying, who's going to come with me to Pluto? And so John Adams says, my son will go. His French was perfect. And though 13, he was, you know, in many ways a grown-up. And so that's what he did. And so they spent months taking carriages across Europe, the endless trip. But he was accustomed at this point to traveling. They get to Russia. It turns out they were wrong. Catherine the Great considered republicanism to be an infectious disease, which she had to make sure no one in her country caught. So she would not receive Francis Dana. And so basically the two of them spent 10 months doing absolutely nothing whatsoever. Adams wrote long letters back home to mommy and daddy about, you know, what he saw and what Russia was like, some of which are very, very astute about the nature of Russian society. He recorded, he read David Hume's 5-volume history of the English Republic, and so every day his journal would be something like, well, got up to page 443, and, you know, you can imagine, it's freezing cold, there's nothing to do, he's just sitting reading all day. So that was his first experience, though not his last experience of Russia.
So his observations of what was going on in Europe, what was going on in Russia, found their way to what? To some fairly important times in history.
Well, so that, Kathleen, that's later. And so now, when he was 13, the letters were just to his parents.
I see.
It's when he, later on, then he, after Harvard, several difficult years, he gets appointed as an ambassador. And so then, when he's an ambassador, this is now during George Washington's second term in office, he's writing these letters as an official diplomat, to the Secretary of State, but he also sends letters to his father, then Vice President, who shows these letters to Washington, who says, this is a young man whom we must keep in the diplomatic service.
Interesting. And at one point, tell me more about this story, during the second go-around in Paris, the Marquis de Lafayette gives him seven, I love dogs, so any dog story you can weave in is great, gives him seven hunting dogs that he's in charge of to bring back on the boat to Washington?
I don't know that he had to, you know, go down into the hold and feed these dogs, but so in 1783, he's now 16 years old, and it has been agreed that he must return to the United States, otherwise he'll turn into a European, which was would have been okay with him, but a horrifying thought to his parents, so you must come back. So he's going to go to Harvard. And so, yes, the Marquis de Lafayette, a family friend, dispatches six hunting dogs as a gift for General Washington. And so he dispatches them with John Quincy. So John Quincy, I imagine, probably hands them to some lackey and says, just make sure they, you know, live over the course of the voyage. So yes, then I guess he doesn't describe delivering them, so I don't know what becomes of them.
No, we'll have to find out that story. So he comes back to go to Harvard and has to take, here's this brilliant young man who has to take a rigorous Harvard exam, and they're, well, maybe we'll let you in, maybe we won't. Tell me about that exam and what his thoughts were about going to Harvard.
So the exam consisted of being cross-examined by the president of Harvard and a few other people. And he, of course, at that time thought he was just about, you know, the most hot stuff around, and he was.
Right. Yes.
But his Greek wasn't very good. His Latin was quite good, but his Greek was not. I mean, his knowledge of literature was, I think, I would guess, exceptional, even among that hothouse group. And so they said, sorry, you're not ready to get into Harvard, which probably was the first time in his entire life that anybody had ever said anything to him that implied he was inferior to other members of his peer group. Until then, he'd always been told his whole life that he was just, you know, the greatest young American there was. And so that was kind of a shock. The advantage of it, though, was that he then had to go with his uncle, his mother's brother, and spend time preparing, which meant that he was in the little town of Haverhill, which was full of young persons, for example, young girl persons.
Uh-huh.
And that was new for him. You know, he had swanned around in Europe, you know, with women far older than he and had had distant crushes on them, but that was all. Maybe he danced with them, I don't know, but that was all. Now, he'd go sledding with these girls, you know, and they probably had stolen kisses and things like that. So now he starts writing all sorts of poems and stories and sketches of personalities, most of which are extremely harsh. And his sister reproves him and says, you know, no woman likes a man who has such a low opinion of her sex. But it doesn't really affect him very much. So this was a new thing for him, and that he liked very, very much. And then he goes off to Harvard, which where also he's got classmates, and he's never had this before. So he's only in Harvard for a year and a half. He's admitted, in effect, in the middle of his junior year. But he loves that period of time. He just loves it. It's the only time in his life, really, where, you know, he had boon companions and his own peers were his friend group.
He'd never been happier than at Harvard, you write in your book.
Yeah, I believe that's true.
And then what's to follow is legal drudgery, and we'll talk about that and, of course, talk about the presidency, the election of 1824, where it was, it was decided by the House of Representatives, which is quite an interesting story. We'll talk about the Monroe Doctrine. We'll talk about his time as presidency, his thoughts on slavery, and his going back to the House. We have a whole life to flush out here. And we'll welcome your phone calls. Our phone number, as we talk about John Quincy Adams, our sixth president, with the author of John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit, James Traub, is with us. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Let's take some phone calls for our guest before we move beyond Harvard with John Quincy Adams. Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm intrigued by a comparison I could make between Barack Obama and John Quincy Adams in the early part, in say around the Treaty of Ghent, which I think was in the 1820s. Resisted proposals to give Indian lands over for an Indian nation. But he did not like Jackson's execution of Seminole Indians in Florida. And later, as president, he opposed. Oppression of Indian policy, such as that expressed by Henry Clay, and he then near the end of his term, I think he said one term, didn't he?
Yes.
Near the end of his term, he opposed Indian removal in mm-hmm. Georgia, which was especially brutal.
James, what do you say about those instances?
I would love for all that to be true. I think the best one can say for Adams's views of Indian policy and Indians is he was a lot less brutal than the most brutal, for mm-hmm. example, Andrew Jackson. And he was genuinely shocked when he heard Henry Clay, his Secretary of State, say, look, they're going to get removed anyway. Let's stop fiddling about. Let's just remove them. But the fact is, Adams had a view that ownership of land, belonged only to those who tilled it, that the act of tilling the land was what created ownership. It was, in his mind, a biblical view. And so from his point of view, nomads, Indians, had no actual title to the land. He didn't believe they had a right to it. And so he didn't want them to be treated brutally, but neither did he question the right of white settlers to take the land from the Indians. He wanted the treaties with the Indians to be fair, but in the end he wound up approving some treaties that were quite brutal. I do think that the sort of the best one can say is that he saw that there was a, that he was in a kind of vise, because the pressure from settler movement westward was absolutely irresistible. And there was his own profound commitment to fair-mindedness meant he wanted the Indians to be fairly compensated. But at the end, he understood he could not put himself in the way, or he would not put himself in the way, for example, of the really racist, brutal Georgia governor who said, we're taking that land one way or another. And so he was, in the end, party to extremely brutal treatment of Indians, even though he deserves to be thought of more, a little more charitably than Andrew Jackson.
Interesting. Let's move in then to his thoughts about slavery.
Well, now we're on a profound subject,
right.
So and very much definitional with Adams. And so Adams, like any other reasonably minded, thoughtful New Englander, thought slavery was utterly evil. He thought it was against the dictates of the Bible. He thought it was against the terms of the Declaration of Independence. He thought it was despicable. At the same time, he thought, there's nothing I can do about it. The Constitution was silent on the question of slavery, and therefore it was left to the states. And so the southern states had it, the northern states didn't, and that was that. That changed in 1820 when the debate arose over the admission of Missouri, because if Missouri came in as a slave state, there'd be more slave states than free. And so that caused an enormous debate. And Adams suddenly reflected on something he'd never reflected on before. And once he reflected on it, he was such an intellectually honest man that he would not let his thoughts just be trammeled up by what was practical or pragmatic. No, he said, this is a terrible evil. And he said, I can see, I look down the road, and I can see that this issue cannot be resolved. And ultimately, we will be dividing ourselves into a free and a slave nation, and that can't work for long. There will be, he said, if I have to guess, he said, there will be a war between these two parts of the Union. And then quite astonishingly, he says, as desolating as that would be, as unspeakable and terrible as that would be, a war between North and South, he said, if that is God's instrument to bring an end to slavery, let it be so.
Wow. That's
pretty
remarkable.
And for anyone of his nature who believed in the Republic above all, to say that, even in the privacy of his own journal, and that's where he said it, was a great act of intellectual honesty. He didn't act on any of that for another 15 years, but the thought was there.
And was he talking about slavery when he died in the House, when he was, after presidency, he became a member of the House? Was he talking about slavery at his death?
No, I mean, literally at his death. No, I mean, literally at his death, he was casting a vote on whether or not the veterans of the Mexican-American War should be given special pensions, which he didn't want, which he opposed because he had opposed the war. But the core of his period in the Congress and the great focus of his life from 1835 to 1845 was slavery and the issue of whether or not Congress had a constitutional obligation to receive petitions from citizens seeking an end to or some kind of curb on slavery, something which he defended at times absolutely alone and then later with more and more company.
And the prohibition was lifted, I think you say, in 1844, is that
1845,
right?
I think. So it was a 10-year-long crusade.
Goodness.
And it really was a crusade. On two separate occasions, he became so enraged and the battle inside the Congress became so vehement that Southerners moved to have this man, who by this time, of course, was the former president of the United States, censured, formally censured by the House. And in each case, Adams took them on, the first time really alone, the second time with company, and beat them soundly to the point where they all each time regretted that they had tried to do this.
And tell me about his argument before the pro-slavery Supreme Court on the African captives of the slave ship Amistad.
Amistad, right. Yeah. So this, by the way, is the only thing about Adams which has made it into popular culture. There's a bad movie starring Anthony Hopkins called Amistad. And Anthony Hopkins plays a kind of genial Cracker Barrel version of John Quincy Adams, who's like way nicer and more backslapping than the real one. But it's a great moment. So Adams is now, this is now 1839. Adams is 72 years old. And this group of they weren't slaves, really. They were because the slave trade was no longer permissible. These are people who were brought from Africa at a time when the slave trade was no longer allowed, but they were treated as slaves. They were on a boat. The boat was seized, and they were supposed to be returned to their owners, but they weren't actually slaves. And Adams and many others said, these men are not slaves. Well, the fact is they had mutinied on the ship. They had killed their captain. They had killed one other person, the cook. They had demanded that the remaining mates bring them back to Africa, which they had not done. So these men were murderers who also in some ways were treated as slaves. And Adams said, his private attitude was, well, I'd murder them too. I mean, well, what were they supposed to do? So even though they had committed this terrible act, he said these men had their freedom stolen from them. And so he was then approached to be the lawyer who would take this case to the Supreme Court. They had been freed by a lower court, and then the case had been appealed to the Supreme Court. And he said, I haven't appeared before a court in 40 years. Well, 35 years. And they said, no, it must be you. Because as the former president, he could speak in a way that nobody else could. He could speak to the justices as an equal or more than an equal. And so he prepared for months. He was someone who never underprepared. He always overprepared. And he spoke over 2 days for 8 hours. Now, you know, now you go before the Supreme Court. If you get 8 minutes before they interrupt you, that's fantastic. That wasn't true in those days. So he gave this incredible eight-hour oration where he said he pointed to the Declaration of Independence, which was posted on the wall, framed on the wall of the court. And he said, by that document on the wall, you must find these men innocent, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they probably would have been found not guilty in any case, but of the eight justices, one, believe it or not, had actually died in the course of these proceedings. That's how long Adams spoke for. Of the eight remaining justices, seven had been appointed by pro-slavery presidents. Nevertheless, Adams won 7-1, and it was an astonishing victory. Yes. It was celebrated all over the country, and it made him a revered figure.
Interesting. And what about, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to know about public opinion concerning Adams. I think that you've said that he kind of discounted the voters and discounted his party, which didn't make him all that wildly popular. But was he held in esteem among the people in this country or not?
Not at first. When he was, so he was a one-term president, just like his father had been, but really beaten soundly by Andrew Jackson in 1828. And when he left, people just thought he's an old fossil. He represents this old New England world. Andrew Jackson is the new world. And that was it. That was supposed to be the end of his career. Then he has this astonishing last phase of his career where he becomes a moral hero for having defended principles and having stood up to the slave power. And so there's a lovely moment when in 1843 he makes a kind of barnstorming tour to the West, which in those days meant Cincinnati, Ohio, or Covington, Kentucky. And people come out in droves to hear him. And he is treated, he is now 75 years old, treated as the last living link to the founding fathers. He is revered. And some newspaper editor says that the people have at long last taken a second look and understood that they had never seen this man for who he was. The man didn't change. People finally understood, and that really is what it felt like to him. It was enormously gratifying, and to me, it's kind of a great sentimental moment of his life. That people come. This man clung to his beliefs, clung to his principles, unpopular though they were, never changed in any way, never did anything to court public opinion. And ultimately, people came to him and saw him.
And accomplished, you write, little of his ambitious agenda. What was that agenda, and what was he able to accomplish, and what wasn't he able to accomplish?
Well, so as president, he'd been a great Secretary of State, but foreign policy was no longer a big deal because the United States, first of all, was no longer at war, and second, the great territorial issues, which essentially meant America gaining control over the continent, were temporarily in abeyance during that period. So the great questions were domestic policy. Well, Adams had a very ambitious agenda. He believed in an activist government. He and Henry Clay, as Secretary of State, were really the foremost proponents of the view that America, that you needed to have a government that actively promoted manufacturers, and that meant using protective tariffs, for example, but it also meant the investments in infrastructure. In those days, they said internal improvements, but Adams was the, that was the word they used then. And Adams was prepared to spend a lot of money doing this. And he believed, he said later, that he had this notion that not only would the infrastructure be good, the toll bridges and so on, but it would put people to work. I mean, it's a little bit like the way Obama in 2009, or for that matter, any president who wanted to engage in Keynesian spending, a time long before Keynes had ever formulated this theory, that they would think. And that's how Adams thought. He thought an activist government would be the best way of promoting a powerful nation with a strong economy. Well, everything he suggested failed. The Congress was absolutely against him from the word go. He never had a chance. He was totally unwilling to play the political game. He wouldn't trade favors with anybody. He wouldn't flatter anybody. He wouldn't threaten anybody. And so he just thought, I'm going to say what's right, and then they should adopt it. But if they don't, that's not my fault. It's not my responsibility. And so he was he failed, and it was his fault. He was a bad politician. He didn't believe in politics in that respect. He believed in politics as the cockpit or theater in which great ideas are fought out. But he did not believe in politics as an instrument with all of its special tricks and means and so forth. Which one has to use in order to get something accomplished.
Interesting. So do you compare him to Obama in that regard?
No. No American president in the modern era would ever be like that, because you can't get elected unless you already know how to appeal to people. I mean, I think, you know, Obama is a very, very gifted politician who understood when he ran for president at a profound level how to use language to appeal to people. What he was not, and here you could say yes, a little bit like Adams, he's someone who didn't like politics either and who found it morally beneath him, mm-hmm. and who projected, I think Obama projected the idea that it was beneath him.
Yeah.
And so he was not willing to use the kind of wiles that Bill Clinton did. I mean, in that sense, Bill Clinton was a far more effective politician than Obama. Obama was a world-class campaigner and a great, great speaker.
Absolutely.
But not an eager politician at all.
Mm-hmm. John Quincy Adams wrote and wrote and wrote, kept a diary for years.
There is no document in American life that compares to his journal. It's 17,000 pages long. And, he was such a harsh taskmaster on himself. And had he not been, at some point he would have said, you know what, I'm president of the United States. I don't have time to spend 40 minutes a night writing my journal. But that's not how he thought. That's not what he said. He, as president, at everything for 60 years of his life, he kept his journal every day with a few intervals, but very, very few. And he would write down everything he did, thought, said, felt in the course of the day. Not everything. Probably there are many things he didn't have time, but a lot. A lot. And so for the historian, it's an unimaginable resource.
Because, I imagine.
You know, when you write about a 19th century figure or older, you don't really know very much about what happened. You're imagining what might have happened. And so the historian is always writing something like, he must have thought this. He must have felt that.
Mm-hmm.
With Adams, you almost never have to say that. We know what he thought. We know what he felt. It's quite astonishing. And he was, he wrote brilliantly. He upbraided himself all the time for being a boring diarist and said, I really haven't written down anything worth recording, but that wasn't so. And thank God his son, to whom he entrusted it, Charles Francis Adams, didn't think that was so either, and so he kept it. He didn't burn it.
We welcome more phone calls. We're speaking with James Traub this hour. about the sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams. His book is John Quincy Adams, Militant Spirit. And we're welcoming phone calls along the way here, too, if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. And we go back to phone calls. Let's go to Amanda in Waupaca. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Oh, I had a quick question. I know James mentioned that John Quincy Adams didn't do much campaigning. So I was wondering, how did he get elected? And then also, was he elected just because he was his father's son?
Well, okay, those are two very good questions. And the answer is, nobody campaigned in those days. One did not run for office. One stood for office, and it's a very meaningful difference of verbs. And so what you would do is you would have your friends, that's what they were called, your supporters, would do things for you. They would speak to newspaper editors. They would speak to influential people. Sometimes they would buy newspaper editors. So campaigning really meant authorizing your friends to go out there and beat the bushes for you. Well, Adams was such a purist that he wouldn't even authorize his friends to do it. And there are letters from his friends saying, like to Louisa, John Quincy Adams' wife, saying, will you please tell him to let me campaign for him?
It's wild.
And Adams would grimly say, no, if the public wants me, they will choose me. Well, even that early in 1824, that would not normally get you elected. The reason that he won is, first, that he did have a tremendous record of success. And at that time, if you had worked your way all the way up to Secretary of State, you normally became president. The previous two presidents, Madison and Monroe, had been Secretary of State, and that was just the stepping stone to the presidency. And Adams had enormous built-in advantages, very much including his father. And so that helped a great deal, but he got far fewer popular votes and far fewer electoral votes than Andrew Jackson did. But as Kathleen mentioned, the issue was thrown into the House of Representatives because nobody got a majority. There were five different people running.
And then what happened in the House? Were there some deals going on there? How was that handled?
So this has only happened once in American history, that election, the 1824 election. And so just very briefly, the way the system works, according to the Constitution, is that each state in the House has one vote. Doesn't matter if it's a big state or a small state, one vote. So at that time, there were 24 states. You had to win 13 votes. Adams came in with too few votes. People thought Jackson would win. And he agreed with Henry Clay that Henry Clay said, I'm going to vote for you. They had some kind of deal, not clear what. Henry Clay, in the end, was able to persuade his own native state of Kentucky and probably also Michigan and Illinois to go for Adams, which otherwise they would not have done. Adams then makes Clay a Secretary of State. Jackson cries foul. This is a corrupt bargain. You traded an office to become president, which is at least plausibly true. And so he did become president, but under a cloud.
Thanks so much, Amanda. Let's go to Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm wondering, with all of this writing that the guy did, did he say anything about his ideas surrounding the question of what is money? We know that Ben Franklin thought that money should be created directly as a function of government. We know that Jefferson was against the idea of governments borrowing money from banks and wishes that that wasn't part of the capabilities of government. We know that Lincoln created money directly out of Treasury through the greenback dollar process. Did Adams say anything about his notions of the insanity of bringing money into existence and almost all of it, which is our present system, that we borrow money directly into existence from banks
So just to answer, Adams didn't think much about that abstract question. He did think about banks and banking. And so there was a huge debate in the early 1830s over whether or not the Second Bank of the United States would be granted a new charter. Jackson was deeply hostile to banks. He thought of them, I think, as being corrupt. He also had suffered quite a bit himself with loans going bad, so he wanted to kill that bank. Adams was very close to the man who ran the bank, Nicholas Biddle, and so he worked tirelessly to get the bank rechartered. So in that sense, Adams was a Hamiltonian who did believe in the federal government's role as a source of liquidity. Ultimately, Jackson won that battle, and the Bank of the United States went out of existence.
Thanks so much for your call. Sarah in Zion is next. Hi.
Okay. Hi there. Very interesting. In the miniseries John Adams, John Quincy wanted to marry a woman who his father disapproved of, and I think his father said, if you marry this woman, you are no longer my son, and so John Quincy gave her up. And is that true, and how did that affect John Quincy?
Oh, that's a yes, and that's a very sensitive question for a John Quincy Adams biographer. So one great love of his life is Mary Fraser, of whom, alas, no picture seems to survive, but everybody said she was beautiful. So she's 15, which at that time was considered of age. Adams was 21. He fell in love with her, and apparently she was quite an extraordinary young woman. But he wasn't ready. He couldn't support her, and one could not marry a woman whom one could not support. And so actually it was Abigail, not John, who said to him, I hear that you were courting some woman. I hope you fully understand you were not able to marry her. And Adams, obedient to the last, said, no, of course, I know that perfectly well. I never would. And so there was agonizing for him, and he tried to get her to pledge that she would marry him when he became a lawyer. But he wouldn't let it be public. He would not, in effect, I guess, publish the banns, you would have said then. And she, or maybe her family, said, well, in that case, no. And he was devastated. What she felt, we don't know. He was utterly devastated. It was the heartbreaking event of his life.
Hmm. Thank you. And we'll talk about who he did marry in a moment. But we need to talk about his depression. I didn't realize he suffered from pretty deep depression after Harvard, didn't he? And also during other times in his life?
Yeah, well, it was kind of a family characteristic. The father talked about the blue devils. And so did his brother. But Adams, it makes sense because he was kind of a joyless person in the first place. But I think also he was so driven. And there was a certain point where I think he looked up and said, why? Why am I suffering like this? Why am I beating myself up like this? And there may have been many moments like that, but there was only one moment when he really was paralyzed by it. And so that was when he had actually left Harvard to go to study for the law, which he hated doing. And so, there was a period of a year in his life where he stops keeping his diary. We have a few letters from him, not many. And then he basically stays with his beloved aunt, and eventually he gets back up on his feet and goes about his way. But clearly it was something he had to battle in one way or another for his whole life. And I think he battled just by grim determination and work.
Hmm. Let's talk about Louisa Catherine Adams, his wife. You have an interesting piece at the end of the book in which you talk about what people said about him, eulogies. You say that his soul she had penetrated as no other mortal had, and whom she found exasperating, tendentious, intolerant, self-absorbed, and yet in the end magnificent. How did she pierce his soul as nobody else had, or penetrate his soul?
She was a very she was someone who had always kind of sat at the edge and watched. And so she was a watchful, observant person. She didn't really know him when they got married. I mean, I'm not even sure she loved him. He was kind of in love with her. He proposed to her. He was very eligible. She said okay. But he was a very hard man to be married to. He had had parents who loved each other, and the father was extremely and profoundly solicitous of, John of Abigail and respected her advice so much. That's not how John Quincy felt. He never spoke to his wife about his work. He never asked her opinion about anything he should do or say. He felt that she belonged in the nursery or the salon. He had a very old-fashioned attitude towards her, and he was a cold person. And she was a very sensitive, delicate person, and she suffered a lot. Mm. And there was one terrible moment she wrote when they were in the White House. She wrote a play, which is a thinly veiled drama about herself and him. And his name is Lord Sharpley.
Ooh.
That's kind of all you need to know.
Really?
And the fact that the First Lady could have written such a thing about the President of the United States, it kind of makes your blood run cold.
Mm. And yet, he was magnificent, was he?
Well, yeah. yeah, he was magnificent. I mean, and she knew that, too. I mean, this was a man who withstood death threats without even batting an eye, who welcomed single combat against the entire slaveocracy, as he put it, who would never deviate from his own principles. This was a heroic man, but he wasn't a very nice or warm person.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us. It must have been wonderful to spend a lot of time with such a magnificent man.
Yes, actually it was.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The book is John Quincy Adams' Militant Spirit. James Traub is the author. He's a columnist, a regular contributor at foreignpolicy.com. He teaches foreign policy at New York University and is also author of The Freedom Agenda. And it's quite a book. We love doing presidential history books from time to time. So if you have suggestions of books you've read or of presidents you want us to talk about, feel free to give us a holler and we'll be happy to look into it. Thanks so much to KP Whaley. Oh, KP produced this show some time ago before he left us. And Scotty Myers for producing this show, and Lisa Nalbandian and Colleen Duvall for on-air production. And thanks to everybody for your calls. News is coming up. We'll be with you again on Monday. Don't forget our Dr. Martin Luther King Day celebration, and we'll be on the air to talk about Dr. Martin Luther King following the celebration.